G'day. Indy Wood is my name. You are listening to The Local Update, a podcast produced by Indy Media, looking at local issues and events around the Bega Valley. Every week we'll update you on local politics, social issues, news and current affairs, the arts and creative endeavours happening around the Bega Valley. My name is Indy Wood. I'm your host each week. And I hope you enjoy what you hear here on The Local Update. Every week, my regular guest is Mr. Graham Farram from the Bega Pioneers Museum. So, in awareness, I guess, of the coronavirus issue that we're going through around the world at the moment, we're going to do things a little bit differently over the next few weeks, and we will do as many of these interviews as we can over the phone. So, with that introduction out of the way, here is your session for this week with Graham Farram.
Thanks, Indy. It's a pleasure to be here, although it's normally a pleasure to be standing in the foyer of the Bega Pioneers Museum. The Pioneers Museum, for many years, it was built in about 1857, 58, was a hotel. And for a long time, it was called the Family Hotel. But I've been celebrating the fact that Henry Lawson had come to the South Coast, little bits of stories and books called Tales of the Far South Coast. But I've got a book called Favourite Poems of Henry Lawson, Paintings by Rex Newell, Introduction by Margaret Olds, it's a Child and Associates, first edition 1968. It's available from the local Bega Valley Shire Library. That's assuming that the library is going to stay open. But this one is on page 46 and 47, and it's Callaghan's Hotel. There's the same old coaching stable that was used by Cobb and Co. And the yards coaches stood in more than 60 years ago. And the public private parlour where they served the passing swell was the shoeing forge and smithy up at Callaghan's Hotel. There's the same old walls and woodwork that our fathers built to last. And the same old doors and wainscot and the windows of the past. And the same old nooks and corners where the Jim Jams used to dwell. But the Pantons dance no longer up at Callaghan's Hotel. There are memories of old days that were red instead of blue, in the time of Dick the Devil and of other devils too. But perhaps they went to heaven and are angels doing well. They were always open-hearted up at Callaghan's Hotel. Then the new chum, broken-hearted, and with boots all broken too, got another pair of bluchers and a quid to see him through. And the old chum got a bottle who was down and suffering hell, and no tucker bag went empty out of Callaghan's Hotel. And I sit and think in sorrow of the nights that I have seen, when we fought with chairs and bottles for the orange and the green, for the peace of old Ireland, till they rang the breakfast bell, and the honour of the old England up at Callaghan's Hotel. Now, I've not ever found another copy of that poem in all the different Henry Lawson collections that I've been looking through. Certainly excellent paintings by Rex Newell. I did particularly like the old coaching stable. Well, that's on the opposite corner to the Bega Pioneers Museum. And by an irony, one of the longest serving publicans and the last person to privately own the what is now the museum were both blacksmith. And I might be able to tell you more about them on another occasion. But as you all know, before this COVID-19, we've been recovering or trying to recover from a devastating summer of bushfires down here that tore through little towns and out through the countryside for weeks. We couldn't see the countryside for smoke and ash. And I've been to the library, as I say, and I borrowed a book called Lachlan River Wedding and Other Australian Stories in Verse. It's poetry by June M. Montgomery. A little bit of biography here. In 1973, the Montgomerys settled in the Bega Valley, New South Wales, where for almost a decade in the 1980s, their lovely old convent home, purchased from the Sisters of St. Joseph, was open to the public and tourists as an outstanding place of history. June's poetry, a part of her life since her childhood, was published widely in Bega Valley newspapers. Launched to the tourist public from the old convent at Candler, June's poetry found its way into homes all over Australia. One in particular, there are a couple in here that I really like, but one in particular for the bushfire story that I'm trying to tell. This is on page 42. It's called The Chimney Stack. I saw a chimney stack standing alone in a paddock, fence broken, with vines overgrown. As I closer looked, eyes dimmed with tears, I thought of the heartache and somebody's fears. An apple tree by the blackened gate was laden with fruit and seemed to wait for the eager hands that year by year had lightened the branches in the garden here. But where is the garden that used to be? And the old homestead round that chimney? Just bricks and mortar stand alone in a burnt-out garden with weeds overgrown. The grass again is growing green and covers the ruins where the house has been. But the years make this a desolate spot, a place once loved but now forgot. So I tarried a while by the chimney tall, just a passerby, yet I tried to recall with my feelings would be if my home had been here, and my heart was chilled with a terrible fear. For that chimney may be a symbol of death. Some soul in that pyre may have drawn his last breath, and I wondered just when, and my heart questioned why, and I wept for that chimney as I slowly passed by. A little bit sad, this last book was in the throes of production. June's husband had been working on it. That's Keith. He was lovingly proud of my poetry, she says, for the timely and generous help given to me by Mr. and Mrs. Rob Barnett of Canberra to carry on Keith's work to produce this book. I thank them very much indeed. My gratitude to Greg Wollaston of XL Printing down in Pandeville, which is a business which is still growing. Now, I'm not too sure about that Barnett name. They used to own a framing business in what was a private hospital in Candler, and we might speak about them on another occasion. But I thought I'd finish today with a little bit out of these Tales of the Far South Coast. This is a lovely one. The cover has a steamer pulled up at Tata Wharf, which is still there, a heritage wharf, the last deep water steamer port on the Australian east coast. And the drawings by my old friend, Jan Bolsius, who's not with us anymore. But she was a staunch member of the Bega Valley Historical Society. But I'm looking at page 61 of Tales of the Far South Coast, Volume 2, April 1984, and I'm looking at My Life by Harold Wiles. Now, this is a man with an excellent turn of phrase and definitely brought up in the hard school of life. So we're talking, back at the turn of the 20th century here, and up Cathcart Way. This is page 61. On this part of the Monero, there are 11 months of winter and 1 month of cold weather. I have witnessed heavy falls of snow on Christmas Day. Through midwinter, snow would cover housetops. It hung in ponderous masses from rooftops, broke limbs off trees, and it remained in the same position day after day. Unmelted snow clung on every drooping branch of the trees. Sharp biting frost solidified, surrounded, and pervaded everything that was exposed. Dingoes howled with hunger at night, within a few hundred yards of our home. Monkey bears moaned and shivered in treetops through piercing snow and frost. Heavy mountain fogs would black out the moonlight. For our protection, Mother would bolt all the doors before dark. We've had this panic buying going on. We produce three times the amount of food that Australians need, that we seem to be a bit worried about not having it and what it might mean to be in isolation for some time. I think that was a pretty good idea of how isolated you could be up on the Monaro. On page 63, just a little bit here, our main diet consisted of homemade bread and black treacle. We grew our own vegetables. Mother was an expert at gardening. She never grew pansies or violets. She often remarked that cauliflowers were more substantial. On rare occasions, she would buy a sixpenny tin of raspberry jam, and that would be spread as thin as a safety razor blade. Only for the seeds it contained, one would imagine the bread was smeared with carriage varnish. Now, there's a simile that you don't hear much these days. We might talk about carriages later at some time. On page 64, he says, there was no such thing as the dole in those days. If there wasn't enough to eat, you had to drink water and took your belt up a hole. Sometimes a neighbour would kill a fat beast that may have a lump on the jaw and couldn't be sold. We would all be in for a handout, which would be a luxury. Plovers and mud eels, which was classed as good, wholesome food, were frequently on the menu. Now, I don't recommend people go out and do that, but I think we can all take a breath and realise that we are a very, very lucky country. Indigo, that was wonderful. Thank you very, very much. I hope we can do this again next week.
An absolute pleasure, mate. And hey, it is interesting, isn't it? I think that there is the possibility that if things don't really change at some point in the next few months, that we may start looking at food in that way again soon.
And I think that's a real worry, because down here, you know, we have lost so many animals, so much of our landscape. There are unburnt parts of our landscape, but I'm not recommending people go out and get that sand prey off the beach or go and find this or that out in the bush unless they really need to.
No, not at all. I guess what I'm getting at is perhaps we need to start thinking about the way we feed ourselves a bit smarter and start to produce our own stuff and start to, you know, if we do have animals on our land, look at using the whole beast if we actually are going to kill an animal rather than just taking what we think is necessary.
Oh, certainly we could be doing that. You know, that beast with the lump on its jaw that couldn't be sold, I don't reckon there was much left of that after they'd cut that fellow up.
No.
And you know, I hear there's a run on vegetable seeds and you've got to wait 6 to 8 weeks. Really, we should be doing this all the time and have a continuous supply. I've got rhubarb. Hey, that's a standby. It's a great plant to grow. Just needs a little bit of water. I have a grapevine, which is doing really well. If anybody wants to grow a grapevine, there's a trick. You plant it so that when it grows, it's growing on a north-south axis, and that gives sun on both sides of your grapevine.
Very good.
And, you know, the farmer's market was on last Friday. Well, that was really good. I know that there are, you know, sort of food swaps and things like that happen, and that's good too. But do remember, you know, don't mix with too many people. Try and do everything that you can for yourself. I think we all have an opportunity to learn patience and good hygiene just at the moment.
Absolutely. Hey, you have a good week, Mr. Farram, and we'll talk to you again next week.
I'll give you another call. Thanks very much, Indy.
Okay, bye-bye. Graham Farram is the former proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega. He has been involved in the Bega Valley Regional Gallery and for a long time now has been associated with the Bega Pioneers Museum. We catch up with him on a weekly basis to find out what he's found from his collections of history. All right, on the local update, Indy Wood is my name, and this week, coronavirus has got us thinking about how we feed ourselves. Kathleen McCann is a permaculture gardener and educator based in Tanger. I caught up with her recently and I started by asking her what she'd done to her garden to prepare for COVID-19.
I have been growing my own food for the last, let's say, 15 years. I'm a renter, and whatever place I move into, I try and have something going every time I move in. I learned how to, first of all, grow in pots and boxes, ordinary styrofoam boxes. I learned how to do no-dig gardening, which is the quickest way to make a garden when you
now,
move.
Now, that's all significant because that then allows you to be able to just pick up and go if for some reason the situation changes, huh?
Exactly. But what happens with me is I do such a great job on the garden that often the landlord will say, no, can you please leave it there?
Right.
I always take my compost with me. I always take cuttings or plants I know I can transfer with me. But I tend to leave the garden looking 10 times better than it was when I moved in. So I've never had trouble really finding somewhere to live because now I've got a reputation of you should get her. She'll landscape your garden for free and she'll pay your rent for it. But I've always maintained some kind of food in my garden, and I've also, if I'm allowed, I've also had chickens.
So, tell me then, has your situation, has your attitude towards your garden, has what you've got in your garden changed at all in the face of what we have going on at the moment?
No, I'm not doing anything differently at all. I learned how to save my own seed. I have enough connection in my community where we have been doing food swaps and seed swaps now for years. So I know that there's a fantastic resource out there that I've been... You know, I've been ignoring commercial ways of getting food for a really long time now mainly because I have lived below the poverty level for a really long time and I've had to do that anyway. So I don't have the finances to buy, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of plants each year. So I've maintained a way of growing them. And I've also learnt to wild forage as well. So learning about foods that are growing everywhere that you can eat. That's another skill that people will definitely start learning now, I reckon.
Yes, absolutely. So it looks at the moment as though we have perhaps 6 months in front of us where we're going to have trouble with supermarkets and this virus floating around. What's your advice? What would you be putting in your garden now to prepare yourself to be able to feed yourself over this six-month period?
Okay, so depending on where you're living and depending on your water resource, depending on what kind of soils you have, like that's a very open-ended question, Indy, because for people who don't normally garden, this is going to be a huge learning curve. And the best way that they can get information is there are so many YouTube things out there, if they've got access to the internet, ways of how to do gardens. And that's what I'd be doing. I'd be skilling up my skilling up on looking at those videos to see what to do in your garden. And I would suggest looking at ways to improve your soils, how to build compost properly, how to make your own fertilizer, you know, either using animals or worm farms or plants.
So are the soil conditions, etc., going to be that varied within this Bega Valley region?
Absolutely. So on the coast, you've got sandy soils. Then you've got the really heavy clay soils around the Candlo, like, you know, on the escarpment areas. You've got tons of heavy soils full of clay and full of quartz. You've got beautiful soils in some places, but a lot of our soils on the coast have been ravaged by, first of all, over-farming, and then erosion. So the topsoil's really, really minimal. So, you know, there are places where people have difficulty growing all the time. So there are ways to get around that. And like I said before, when I first started, I learned how to grow food in pots and boxes. And styrofoam boxes would have to be one of the biggest polluters of our planet because they can't break down and they can't be recycled. So they end up in landfill all the time. And I learned how to grow food in boxes. And they're very easy to light, move around. They last for at least 3 or 4 years if you can keep them covered as well, because the sun will deteriorate them a bit.
And obviously can control your soil conditions, hey? Building your own soil.
Exactly. You can build it up yourself by using compost and, you know, there's heaps of ways of obtaining things without having to buy it in a bag. From a supermarket, and it's just you just have to get canny, you know. You have to get clever at how you could do make stuff yourself. The other thing I would look at is grey water use and where's your grey water going. I'd also seriously consider learning how to build a composting toilet and using that. And saving that, because that is a fantastic fertilizer for anything that it's not in a vegetable garden. So fruit trees and flower gardens, humanure is fantastic. And there's some excellent resources out there to learn how to do that properly and safely.
One of the things that's happened in this region in the last few years is the development of these FOGO green bins and being able to put your compost in it and go to the tip. What's your assessment of the compost you can purchase from the tip?
Fantastic. It's actually, they've really done their research and they've accepted lots of feedback. When they were first making it, it was too alkaline. So they've started using other things to make it less alkaline and bump it up so it's a lot more useful in the garden. So the FOGO have really, really got their act together, and that's fantastic for people who can't compost. Getting it back off them and putting it back into your gardens is a great idea. After the Tathra fires, that compost was delivered free to quite a few places that had lost their gardens, and they were able to rebuild their gardens back up again, which was wonderful to hear. So that's a great initiative.
So then seasonally, looking at this time of the year, what's worth planting?
Oh, look, well, the quickest and easiest foods to grow would be the greens, things like radishes. I wouldn't be doing any of the heavy cropping vegetables like the brassica family, so broccoli and cauliflower and cabbages, because they take so long to develop to eat. So I'd just be doing things that I can eat now. So I've just planted the garden out with lots of spring onions, lots of chives, lots of flat-leaf parsley. I've put in cos lettuce, which is a really hardy lettuce that you can just pull leaves off around the edges and it'll last for a really long time. It'll keep growing in the garden. I've put in silver beet and English spinach. Silver beet and spinach are two different plants. Silver beet's a very high growing, luscious, big fat leaf, which is fantastic in cooked, because it does have folic acid in it, so you really should eat it cooked. Whereas English spinach is a low-growing, really easy to grow at this time of year because it's cooling off, green, which is delicious raw mostly, but you can also use it cooked as well, but only lightly cooked because it's such a delicate leaf. But it grows beautifully in this area, in all the soils. I've managed to grow that on the coast as well as inland very, very well. And I would also be looking at radishes. It's a really, really quick and easy vegetable to grow. Within 6 weeks, you're eating it. I would start thinking about potatoes and other things that were a bit more filling. Peas, sugar snaps are my favourite pea because you can eat the whole pod. You don't have to shell it. So I'd be looking at vegetables that you can grow where you can eat the whole vegetables. So if you wanted to grow things like beetroot and carrots, a lot of people throw the tops away, but you can actually eat the tops. You can make a fantastic pesto out of carrot tops, and you can make anything you make out of spinach or silver beet, you can make out of beetroot tops. So I'd be looking at how can I eat the whole plant? You know, like I would stop throwing things away into the compost or giving to the chooks, it's fine. But if you wanted to know, you know, and feed your family or feed yourself, learning how to use every bit of the plant. And it's sort of like in the past when people used to use every bit of the animal, nothing was wasted. So when a beast was killed, no matter what it was, whether it was a chook or a duck or a cow, every part of that beast was used to feed the family or have a use of it for whatever practical use. None of it was thrown away. Like our society, sadly, has been encouraged to throw away because that means you need to consume more, which means you need to buy more. And I'm loving what's happening now. It's sort of like the universe is smashing the capitalist system down without much help from radical humans.
You've led very naturally on to what I wanted to ask you about next, which is what do you see changing as a result of this whole event when it comes to our attitudes towards food or our attitudes towards being at home?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Just watching what's happening on social media has been a real eye-opener, I think, for a lot of people, because it's sort of like for years the people who have been worrying about the environment and scientists and you know, radical thinkers and people who are saying we need to stop and we need to stop now, and nothing was happening fast enough. And now it seems like, okay, so this is happening now, we have to do it anyway. And I think there's been enough in entertainment and information on how to do this. So I think there's been enough things on how to grow food, how to build a tiny home, how to look after the environment, how to get healthier, how to live without spending a lot of money. Like all those things have been out in the public arena for quite a long time now. And I think now what's happening is people are being forced into actually, they've been thinking it, or they've been saying, I'm going to do it, and now they're being forced to actually do it. And I think it's a fucking awesome thing.
Yeah.
I'm really happy that, sadly, this means people have died, which is always the way with humans, but it's sort of like the massive wake-up call. So I think it's really interesting that we've just had all these bushfires happen, and we've lost so much forest, which is one of the saddest things that people on the coastal areas are dealing with at the moment, is the loss of biodiversity. And so people have been dealing with that and starting to strategize about how they're going to keep going. And now this is happening, and this is actually affecting the bush a bit, but it's affecting the cities more, and that's where the biggest issues are, is in our cities, not necessarily in the rural areas. I think people in rural areas have been learning how to live well and live a lot better with the natural environment for a very long time, whereas in the cities, they're incredibly cut off, and that's where they are the ones who are going to have to really get their act together if they want to survive the coming years. And I don't think you can put a time on it. I don't think it will be 6 months. I have no idea how long this is going to take. No one does. So I think now it's more along the lines of, okay, so I need to start looking after myself and my family, or my land or my block or my house or my whatever. How am I going to do that today? And I need to start today.
All right. Kathleen McCann, thank you so much for your time.
No worries, Indy. Great to talk to you.
Kathleen McCann is a permaculture gardener and educator based in the Bega Valley. You are listening to The Local Update, a podcast on local issues, events, politics, and more around the Bega Valley. My name is Indy Wood. Thanks for your company for this week. Catch you again next week. Bye now.